You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hi everyone, good afternoon. My name is Mary Ryan. I'm head of events here at the RSA and I'm delighted to welcome you all today for our very special lunchtime talk. It's my very great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's special guest speaker, Cesar Hidalgo. Cesar is an associate professor at MIT, where he heads the Macro Connections Group at the MIT Media Lab. A trained statistical physicist and an expert on networks and complex systems, Cesar has also extensive experience in the field of economic development. He has pioneered research on how big data impacts economic decision-making and was named as one of Wired's 50 people who could change the world. So it really is a treat to have him here with us today. He joins us today to share reflections from his new work, this fantastic new book, which is called Why Information Grows. It really is a multidisciplinary tour de force in which Cesar argues that we need a more sophisticated measure of economic complexity than GDP, which we currently are ruled by, but not for the reasons you might think. So it really is a thrill to welcome you here to the RSA today, Cesar. Without further ado, over to you.
Thank you. So the universe is made of energy, matter, and information. But information is the one that actually makes the universe interesting. Information is the one that gives the universe its structure, its beauty, and its complexity. But for the most part, we don't know what information is and where it comes from. Actually, understanding information has been historically difficult. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to show you what information is. Now, I'm going to show you that the economy is actually made completely out of information, and I'm going to show you what are the mechanisms that nature and society have developed to help information grow. And the story starts by trying to understand how information is related to the physical embodiment in which it always needs to exist. You know, people tend to think of information as messages or something ethereal, something ghostly, but information is physical, like Landauer emphasized often and often again. You know, because information, you know, it's not a thing, but it's the arrangement of the physical things. Think of like when you shuffle a deck of cards. You're not changing the mass, but you're changing the way in which the cards are arranged. And by doing that, you're actually changing information. You know, so information is not a thing, it's the arrangement of physical things. You know? And obviously, you know, we live in a world in which there are things that are arranged in a variety of different ways. And that is kind of amazing, you know. And one of the people that were amazed at that diversity of complexity that we observed was Ludwig Boltzmann. You know, Boltzmann was a famous Austrian scientist, but also was a sad man. And you know, how do I know that Boltzmann was a little bit sad? Because he killed himself, okay? So Boltzmann killed himself, you know, and he killed himself, you know, after a long life in which he made great scientific contributions, but that in some way he understood that were kind of frustrating. You know, late in his life, you know, he had been pushing the idea that atoms were something physical and he was being shut down because of, you know, the fact that atoms were not observable. But what he really wanted to explain was not, you know, just atoms. He wanted to explain the physical order that he observed out the windows of his house or whenever he went out into the world. And he was inspired by two men that had made great contributions here in the city of London a few decades before his contribution. These were Darwin and Wallace. And what Boltzmann saw is that Darwin and Wallace had been able to explain the origins of biological order through the theory of natural selection. And what Boltzmann wanted to do was to try to now explain the origins of physical order. Okay? But what he was able to find was actually exactly the opposite. He found that the universe has a tendency to make order disappear, not grow. Okay? And that's what is known as the second law of thermodynamics. So in simple language, you know, the second law of thermodynamics is this tendency of the universe to average itself out. You know, heat goes from hot to cold. When I speak, I'm encoding information in pressure waves in the air. But as those pressure waves move along the room and they bounce, you know, through this cave, eventually the molecules average out and there are no differences in pressure anymore and that information is gone. That tendency for the universe to average out makes order disappear. You know? So Boltzmann discovers that the universe has this tendency to make order disappear, and the question of where order comes from and why it grows kind of lingers, you know, and it's a question that eluded Einstein, it eluded Gibbs, you know, it eluded Maxwell, which were the other fathers of statistical physics, until Ilya Prigozhin comes along. So Ilya Prigozhin was a Russian-born physicist that did most of his work in Belgium, and eventually what Prigozhin realizes is that Boltzmann was right, you know, the universe has a tendency to make order disappear, but the systems that Boltzmann were looking at were not very representative of the reality of the world that he was trying to explain. Boltzmann were looking at systems that were in equilibrium. So think of, you know, like the cup of coffee in which you put milk, and what Boltzmann was looking at is at the resting state of that, once the milk, you know, is very well mixed in the coffee. And in that state, there's not that much order, the swirls are gone, everything is milky. No, but what Prigozhin realized is that if you wanted to explain order, what you had to do is you had to look actually at systems that were out of equilibrium, you know, when you're just pouring the milk into the coffee, you know, because our planet and our bodies and our society are not systems that are in equilibrium, are systems that are out of equilibrium. They're being forced by the constant ingestion of energy that comes from the sun or from mineral fuels or from the food that we eat in the case of our bodies. So he started to look at the systems that were out of equilibrium, and he realized that these systems did not maximize entropy. The system did something different. They minimized the rate at which they produce entropy. So when you have a system that is out of equilibrium, you know, Prigozhin showed, and he was looking at a particular set of systems that were relatively close to equilibrium, he figured out that actually those systems, yes, they do dissipate, they do produce a little bit of heat, and they increase the entropy of the universe, but they produce as little as possible. And when that happens, those systems produce order. So the example of that is the whirlpool. Okay? So how many of you have ever used a bathtub here? You know? So if you use a bathtub and you take the plunger off the bathtub, you have noticed that basically when the water starts racing down the pipe, the water that is immediately on top of the drain organizes into something that looks like that. You know? And basically that's a little quantum of order. That's a very simple form of physical order. Why is that? Well, because when the bathtub is just sitting there and the water is not racing down the drain, the water molecules are going in any direction. Yeah? But once you take off the plunger, you know, this water self-organized into a structure in which the velocities of the particles are highly correlated. So if you take like two neighboring molecules of water that are going down the drain in the whirlpool, their velocities are going to be very similar. And that is information. The thing is, you know, Prigozhin helped us explain these very primitive, very simple forms of information. But when we look out our windows and we see something as complex as the city of London, you know, we're not going to be able to explain something as complex like that by looking at whirlpools like this. So that means that the universe needs to have a few more tricks that help information grow. The second trick was hinted at by Erwin Schrödinger in his book What's Life from 1944. And there what Schrödinger says is that in some way, you know, life, you know, is a machine that goes against the second law of thermodynamics. You know, it's a machine that is generating order constantly, you know, and to do that, we are consuming energy, but also, you know, what we're doing is we're very careful at preserving the order that we create by crystallizing it in aperiodic crystals. Think of DNA and RNA. DNA and RNA are like deposits of information because they're very stable molecules. So the second trick that the universe needs to develop to help information grow is to develop ways for that information to be stored, to keep that information. And once you keep that information, you can start recombining it and you can create more information. If you did not have solids that you could use to preserve information, basically you would not be able to make information grow that much because you would only have to keep on regenerating information every time. Okay? So the second trick that you need for information to grow is to be able to preserve it, and solids help us do that. But matter has another trick that is the one that allows information to truly explode in the universe. And that before life even can emerge, matter needs to develop the capacity to compute. Okay? Computing is not something that was invented, you know, like a few decades ago. It was something that was understood a few decades ago, but it was invented prior to life by nature. Okay? And one example that we can use that is not prebiotic, but that can help illuminate this idea that computation is something that is essential for the growth of information, is to think of a tree. Because people often do not think of trees as computers, but trees are computers. Okay? A tree knows in which direction to grow its leaves and in which direction to grow its roots. A tree, you know, knows when to turn genes on and off to fight off parasites. You know? A tree knows when to shed its leaves and when to grow them again. It doesn't have a consciousness like you and me, but through all of the biochemical processes that the tree is performing, it's performing computation that allowed the tree to adapt to the environment. So a tree is a computer, and so are we, and so is every cell. You know, and that forms of computation are possible because matter can use energy to store information in solids, and by combining those two things, can develop this capacity to compute. So information can grow despite the second law of thermodynamics because the universe has three tricks that allow information to grow, not globally, but in pockets of the universe. Okay? Pockets like you and me, you know, or pockets like a tree, or pockets like a city. You know, very localized pockets. You know, and those three tricks are, first, you cannot get information for free. Physics tells you that you need to spend energy to produce physical order. Okay? If you don't spend energy, order is going to degrade. Okay, so there is an energy cost to the production of physical order. The second one is that you cannot be too wasteful. You have to be able to save that physical order if you want that order to truly grow. And finally, matter needs to develop the capacity to compute. You know? So now that we know what are the basic mechanisms that allow information to grow in nature, what I'm going to do next is I'm going to try to explain you how these mechanisms get re-embodied in the society and the economy. Okay? And what I'm going to argue is that economies are actually computers that allow us to create the products that augment our capacities and eventually allow us to live at a very high standard of living. Actually, at the end, I'm going to argue that differences in income across countries are differences in the computational capacity of each one of their economies. So let's get started. So the first point that I want to make is I have to first inform you about what is the type of information that we grow in the economy. This is not the information that we have stored on DNA. It's not the information of the workforce that Prigozhin was looking at. It's a different type of information. You know? So to do that, I'm going to tell you a little story. You know, and as you probably hear from my funny accent that maybe you're not able to locate, I'm from Chile. And I've been living in the U.S. for 11 years. And when you're an expat and you live in a foreign country, you often go back to, you know, your home country's newspaper on the internet. No, and one day I was browsing a Chilean newspaper and I found this news. Chilean bought the world's most expensive car. And obviously my reaction was like, what a douche. You know, but, but after that reaction, then I said, well, you know, okay, he bought the world's most expensive car. How expensive is that? And how much does it cost per kilo? Okay? So the car was a Bugatti Veyron. According to, you know, the Google search that I did at that time, it cost $2.5 million. And that's $1,300 per kilo. Okay? Or like $2,600 a pound. Okay? So the question is, well, now imagine you won this car in the lottery, you know? You're driving it, you know, very excited because you have like this $2.5 million car that you just got, and boom, you crash it against the wall. Now, how much is that kilo of Bugatti worth? You don't need a PhD in economics to know that the value of that car decreased sharply, not because you drove it out of the lot, but because you drove it into a wall. Yeah? So, well, what does it tell you? Well, this crash is not like the crash that goes on at CERN. It doesn't change the physics of the particles underneath, you know. Like, this is a crash that only rearranged the way in which those atoms were connected. So what we're destroying here is physical order. What we're destroying here is information. So what this teaches us is that this car was actually made of information and that the value of that car was connected to that physical order. Okay? So, but to understand what's so special about that physical order, we need to compare apples and apples. Okay? So on your right, you have the apples that you buy in the supermarket, and on the left, you have the apples that you use to check your email. You know? And the true difference between those two types of apples is not their price or their complexity, because I can very easily argue that the apple on the right is much more complex than the apple of the left, because the molecular mechanisms that the apple on the right uses to build itself are far superior than any of the mechanisms that are available inside, you know, that silicon apple. The true difference between these two apples is that the first apple existed first in the world and then in our heads. There was a world in which there were apples and there was no word for apple. There was no price for apple. There were no markets for apple. The second apple is an apple that existed first in someone's head and then in the world. And what that tells us is that these products are not just made of physical order, but they're made of crystallized imagination, okay? Which is order that was originally formed on mental computations, and then we disembodied into a product, you know, by putting together a network of people that was able to build that object. So this can help us interpret some interesting macroeconomic processes. So let's think of international trade now that we understand products as embodiments of information and imagination. No, and let's look at the products that Chile exports to South Korea. And this is done in the Observatory of Economic Complexity, which is a data visualization engine for international trade data that I created with one of my students at MIT. Okay, and here we see that Chile exports $4.6 billion to Korea. But we also see what Chile exports to Korea. It exports refined copper, copper ore, raw copper, pig meat, grapes. You know? Now let's see what Chile buys from Korea. And Chile buys from Korea only $2.5 billion. That means that Chile has a positive trade surplus with Korea. But when I look at what Chile buys from Korea, and I see that there are cars, delivery trucks, machines, polymers, sulfuric acid, well, what Korea is sending back is not atoms, but the way in which those atoms are arranged. So while Chile has a positive trade surplus with Korea, it has a negative imagination surplus, okay? Because what Chile is sending is atoms, and Korea what is sending is those atoms back, but in a different arrangement, you know? And that is information, and that also tells us that Korea is a more sophisticated computer than that of Chile. Okay? It's able to put those atoms together. We can also reinterpret rhetorics of exploitation, you know? And in Latin America, these rhetorics are very popular. Because the question is, well, Chile makes a lot of money out of copper. Chile exports like around $40, $50 billion worth of copper every year, depending on the price. That's a lot of cake, yeah? Why would anybody be willing to pay $50 billion a year for those rocks, you know? That's a lot of money, you know? And the reason is very simple. Well, those rocks, if you melt them and you make them into wires, you can use them to conduct electricity, you know? So in some sense, you know, the value is not in the rock, but it's in this application of this rock. But why do we want to create those wires? Well, because some time ago, there was some guys that figured out that if you jiggle a magnet, you know, inside a coil, you can actually generate electricity, and then you can use that to power, you know, the lights that make this basement not a dark place, or the washing machine that you use to wash your clothes, the refrigerator, the computer, everything. You know, so in some way, you know, like what is happening is not that Chile is being exploited because people is taking those rocks out of Chile, is that Chile is exploiting the knowledge and know-how that was developed by a guy that never set foot in Chilean territory, such as Michael Faraday. You know, because by him discovering the laws of induction endowed those rocks with enormous economic value. Yeah? So the question now is, well, why do we crystallize imagination? Why do we bother? You know, and that's kind of not such a trivial question for two reasons. First, we're the only species that crystallizes imagination. All other species are happy to live their lives using whatever nature throws at them as the total inventory. Us, you know, instead, basically living in a world in which all of the products that we use were imagined before they were built. So there must be some benefits, you know, to producing products that we're reaping, and that justifies why we do them. And to answer that question, I have another question for you. And the question is, how many of you use toothpaste today? How many of you use toothpaste today? Sir, you use toothpaste too? Yeah? Yeah? Okay, so now keep your hand up if you use toothpaste, because I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Okay? Now keep your hand up only if you know how to synthesize sodium fluoride. So you see there's a chemist in the room. Yeah. So all hands basically go down. And what this is telling you is that when you're buying toothpaste, you're not just buying paste in a tube. What you're buying is access to the practical uses of knowledge and know-how that reside in the nervous system of people that you might have never met. Okay? So what products are doing is transmitting those practical uses of knowledge and know-how. They're not acts of communication. We're transmitting information, in this case, to augment each other, not to message each other. Okay? And that's what products do. You know? So in some way, we're similar to ants. Because ants are individually not very smart. And we're not very smart either. We think we do, we're not very smart either. But together, ants can do great things. They can solve problems of routing and ventilation and construction. And they can do that because, well, they have a certain property that they share with us, which is this ability to deposit information in their environment. Okay? So ants can poop information. And they poop that information in the form of pheromones. And by pooping information in the form of pheromones, they can coordinate and solve these problems. Now, we are like ants. We're also an eusocial species. But unlike ants, we don't just poop information by using a vocabulary that was predetermined and encoded in our genes. We poop information that comes from our brain. And by creating objects that came from our brain, is that we're able to generate a society that is infinitely more complex than those of ants. So the question that I'm going to explore next is, well, how do we get to do all of this? Hopefully by now, I made you think of the products that you use every day in a different light, you know? Because these products are not just kind of like these stupid trinkets that you're using, but they're actually embodiments of human imagination that augment you, okay? And that allow you to live at this level of prosperity that would be unimaginable if you would not have that capacity to access the practical uses of knowledge and know-how through objects. So the question is, well, how do we do this? You know, what are the social and economic mechanisms that allow us to perform this computation? You know, and what are the limits to our ability to compute? Why cannot we compute even more? You know, why some countries are better than computers than others? So for that, I'm going to tell you a story. A couple of years ago now, there was this guy visited the MIT Media Lab. How many of you know that guy? Sound familiar? Guardiola. Yeah, Pep Guardiola, exactly. So at that time, he was between jobs. He was the coach of Barcelona, and he was going to take the coach of Bayern Munich in a few months from there. You know, and he went to the U.S. because there he was not going to get so much media attention. No, he was living in New York, and he was a friend with Israel Ruiz, which is the treasurer of MIT. So he told Pep, why don't you come and visit MIT? And, you know, he came happily, and he came to the MIT Media Lab, and they say, hey, Cesar, no, Pep Guardiola is coming. You're from Latin America. Why don't you organize the visit? So I said, sure, you know, and it was an easy visit to organize because obviously there were a lot of students that said, oh, shit, Pep is coming. I want to see him, you know. So there were also a lot of students that were not from the Media Lab that wanted to visit Pep. And those students that were not from the Media Lab, you know, they started to email me, and many of them were Spaniards, and they say, Cesar, I really want to meet Pep, I really want to meet Pep. And what I told them is, like, you know, he's going to be here for a very short time, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a Q&A session after we do all of the demos and the, tour of the lab. Okay, you know. So we finish the demos, and then, you know, we have a little stage, and we sit Pep there, and there are, like, a few students there, you know, wearing Barcelona T-shirts and stuff, you know, and they have to ask some questions, you know, and one of the students comes and says, Pep, if we build a team of robots, would you come and coach it, you know? Of course, this is MIT, that was the question, you know? So, you know, Pep thinks about it, and he comes with this very keen answer, and he says, being a coach is difficult not because you have to figure out a game plan, but because you have to be able to embody that game plan in each one of your players. Since in the case of a team of robots and don't see that as a challenge, I decline your offer. Mm-hmm. And what Pep is telling us is that in some way what makes doing great things, such as winning the Champions League or building a very complex product like the iPhone, difficult, is that you cannot do those things alone. You have to do these things in a social context, and embodying computation in a network of people is not easy. Okay? If you think that learning by individuals is hard, learning as networks is even harder. Okay, so why we have to do that? Why we have to go through the trouble to do things as a team? Wouldn't life be simpler if we just could do things by ourselves, you know? And the answer is that, well, you know, actually, we wouldn't be able to get too far, you know, because the people have a finite capacity to accumulate knowledge. So to illustrate that, I'm going to ask you another question, which is, how long does it take to become a dentist? How long does it take to transform a person into a dentist? Anybody would want to... 6 years, 5 years. I say 30 years because people often tend to forget that the people have to learn how to walk and how to talk, and they have to learn math and have to read and how to write and how to, you know, make friends. And basically, by the time you become a dentist, you are in your late 20s, maybe you're 30, your brain is half frozen, you know, and there's not much knowledge that you're going to be able to get into that person's head. Okay? So in some sense, what this illustrates is that our capacity to accumulate knowledge and know-how, our capacity to compute is finite. You know, if we're a computer, we have a finite set of specs, okay? You know, we might be like a Pentium 4, a Pentium 3, but, you know, like, the differences are kind of irrelevant, because what this is telling us is that the capacity that we have to accumulate knowledge is finite, and therefore, if we're going to do things that require a lot of knowledge and a lot of know-how, a lot of computation, we're going to have to divide that computation up in a network of people because of that finiteness. So what this is telling us is that as our society increases its computational capacity, at some point, we're going to cross a limit, which is the person byte limit. A person byte is the maximum amount of knowledge and know-how that you can embody in a person. And that's the natural unit that you have to use when you're talking about computation in society. You know, because what fragments computation in society is the finite capacity of humans. Okay? It's not the bit, it's the person byte. You know? And when that happens, you're going to have to do things in networks of people. So the question was then, well, how big are these networks? You know, what determines the size of this network? How are the size of this network affected by the institutions that we have, you know, by family, by trust, and so forth? So one of the first people to think about this was Ronald Coase. Ronald Coase was a student here at LSE. He was actually studying law, and he went to a presentation from a professor of his in the Department of Commerce, and You know, his professor said one of those things that economists love to say and that often piss people off. You know, this was, the normal economic system works itself out. Okay? And this was 1931, 1932, was the Great Depression. Coase was in his early 20s. He said, this doesn't make any sense, you know, that bothered him, you know. Because basically he said, my economic teachers are telling me that the normal economic system works itself out, but when I go to find a job, what I find is that basically the economy is made of islands of conscious power, and when a worker moves from that position in that desk to that position in that desk, it's not because he's responding to the magic of the price mechanism, it's because his boss told him, hey, now you're there, and the guy moved from here to there. It's a very hierarchical society in the 1930s. So he asked himself the question, well, what determines the size of these islands of centralized planning? Because firms are islands of centralized planning in some way. You know? And he comes up with what is known as Coase theory of the firm. Okay? And the idea is very simple. He says when you are in a firm, you have two options. You can either try to produce things internally, or you can buy it from other people, you know, through a market interaction. And at some point, those two prices are going to be the same. So at the point in which buying things actually becomes cheaper than doing them internally, you're going to prefer to buy rather than to make, and that's going to determine the border of this network that you're forming that is called the firm. But what this also tells us is that actually there is a negative relationship between the transaction cost and the size of the networks that we can form. Because if links are very expensive, you know, you can form only very small networks. If links are very expensive, you can afford very few of them. If links are very cheap, you can form very large networks. So the size of the network that you can form are related to the cost of creating an interaction. So that was all fine and dandy, you know, and it helped kind of like explain the size of the firms in a context that was, in some sense, akin to the way that economists thought. But obviously, after a while, the sociologists came and say, hey, you know, you kind of like are forgetting like maybe the most important half of the story. So Mark Granovetter, you know, is someone that thought about the economy in a very different way. So Granovetter, you know, challenged economists because economists were saying that the links that we form were an epiphenomena of like market forces, you know. But what Granovetter says is no, in reality, society comes with a lot of pre-existing social structure. People are not born into markets. They're born into families. And then they go to school, and they have to become friends with whoever is in that class, you know, because you're in the shared social foci, and that's about it. So the social interactions that you have are kind of like predetermined and fixed by some sociological processes. That determines the networks that we form. And eventually, you know, the economy is kind of like constrained to these pipes that are generated by sociological processes. Okay? So sociology generates the pipes, and then economies, you know, have to work, you know, through these pipes that are generated by these social processes. So he comes up with this theory of embeddedness. Now, he had to generate some data to prove that that theory was kind of correct. So what he did is at that time he was doing his PhD in Boston, and he did a large survey in the suburb of Newton to try to figure out how people got jobs. This is in the late 60s, and what he found is that more or less 50% of all people got jobs through a friend of a friend. Okay? So basically that social network was determined 50% of the allocations being done in one of the most important markets, which is the labor market, which is the market by which people grow the networks of people that they use to compute things and make products. And many people after him basically repeat these studies in different countries, in different locations, and more or less they find always a number that fluctuates, you know, around 50% plus minus 10%. You know, half of all jobs are assigned, you know, through friends of friends. They're assigned through the social network. And not only half of jobs are assigned through a social network, but the best half of jobs are assigned through the social network. If you're looking for a new CTO or CFO for your company, that's probably someone that someone in your firm already knows. If you're looking for someone that is going to do a job that is much more standardized, you know, for example, you know, it's going to be a cleaning service, then those jobs tend to be assigned through normal type of traditional market mechanism, like an ad on a web page or an ad on a newspaper, you know. And even with the invention of the internet and all of the rise of communication technologies, that has not changed. And still, social networks are extremely important. So why they're so important? Why these pre-existing social structures are so important to form the networks that we use to compute collectively? Well, and the answer, you know, came also from Granovetter, but also by people like Fukuyama and Robert Putnam, you know, which is that social networks are not just a collection of interactions. They are the embodiments of trust. You know, like a social interaction is meaningful only as long as I trust someone else. What trust means, for instance, for Granometer, is that you are going to do what is right for me, even when you have the incentive to do the opposite. No? So if you trust your husband or your wife, it means that your husband or your wife is not going to cheat on you, even when they are very tempted by someone that might want them to cheat on you. Okay? So they're doing something that is right for you, even when they have the incentive to do the opposite. Okay? So that's trust. And that trust, you know, reduces the cost of transactions. Because if you trust someone, you can do transactions very fluid with them. You know, you don't need to develop that relationship anymore. You know, you already have it. So you can be very quick in communicating. You're not going to cut the relationship if the person makes a little mistake. You know, you have something that is stable. But that trust needs to exist somewhere. It doesn't exist like in the ether. You know, it exists in social networks. So what Fukuyama did is then he also reinterprets his transaction cost theory in the context of trust. And what he said is that, well, on the one hand, you have societies that have a low level of trust, that people don't trust each other. You know, everybody is out to get you. There are societies in which people have high level of trust. And in the low trust societies, people can form relatively small networks. In the high trust society, people can form large networks. And that helps determine the mix of products that different locations make. Because in the one hand, you have these familiar societies, which are low trust societies. And low trust societies are familiar societies because when you don't have trust, you have to use the only reservoir of trust that is left, and that is the family. You know, the problem is that the family is a reservoir of trust, but it's a very limited pool of talent. So in familiar societies, which are families that have societies that have low levels of trust, you know, businesses tend to be dominated by families. And since those families have a limited pool of talent, they tend to gravitate towards relatively simple industries. Okay? So a family group can run a big supermarket chain in which you are hiring a lot of people that do relatively repetitive things. You know, but having a family business turned into something like Apple or Tesla is a different story. Because there you need, you know, an elite of people that is not just managing the business, but it's actually inventing the products that the business is gonna do. It's a different type of ballgame. You know? So familiar societies produce networks that are relatively small, that are made mostly of kin, you know, and they gravitate towards simpler industry, agriculture, mining, retail. They also have societies that when the people come together, they tend to protest rather than try to self-provide, you know, the inputs that they're missing. On the other hand, you have high trust societies, you know, and on high trust societies, people form large networks of non-kin, and these large networks are able to gravitate towards more complex industries. Why? Because they're larger computers that can embody more computation. So they gravitate to complex industries, and also they self-generate instances of socialization and social capital accumulation by creating events and by creating societies that allow these people to get to know each other and develop the trust that they need to do things. So now, you know, we know that basically to create products, we need to embody computation in networks of people. And there are mechanisms that limit our ability to create those networks. On the one hand, we have pre-existing social ties that constrain those networks, you know, from fundamental sociological perspectives. Then we have trust that modulates the size of the networks that we're able to build. You know, and we even have the transaction costs that can speak more about like technology and, you know, different type of things that change the cost of a market interaction, as was explained by Coase. But all of those things imply that the networks that we're going to be able to form in some way also have a finite size. And if they have a finite size, well, they have a finite capacity. So we have another limit, which will be the Fermi limit. So as the economy grows large and we try to keep on making information grow, at some point we're going to have to re-quantize and renormalize, you know, our computers again, you know, and we're going to have to create things not on networks of people, but on networks of firms. Okay? And actually, we already live in a world in which things are made on networks of firms. So think of a computer. A computer is a product that even though it might have a brand that was slapped there by the company that made it, actually has parts that are made by a whole ecosystem of companies. And then you're running software that is made by yet another network of people. You know? And then some of those software, for instance, include browsers, and those browsers you use to go to or navigate to pages that are yet created by a different group of people. You know? And then those web pages, obviously, they are profitable because they run ads, you know? And they run ads that advertise products that are created by yet a different group of people. So you see that by creating these networks of firm, we're able to close these very long loops and create very sophisticated computers that allow us to create very sophisticated forms of information, like the car that we crashed in the beginning. So what we can say is that Pep Guardiola was right. You know, what makes, you know, accomplishing different things in the world is embodying knowledge, know-how, and computation in that network of people. So the last thing that I'm going to talk about is, well, how does this apply to the macroeconomy? You know, how do we know that any of this, you know, might be true? Can we have some data, you know, that can help us see the economy as a computer and try to understand what is the computational capacity of different economies? And to do that, I'm going to show you, you know, four stylized facts. All of them are going to be understood in the context of a genotype-phenotype distinction. Everybody here is familiar with, like, the distinction between a genotype and a phenotype? So a genotype is the genetic information that is encoded in your genes. A phenotype is the way that you look or the diseases that you have. It's something that can be observed externally. So, for example, I can look at Annabelle and I can know things about her genes because I can know something about the color of her eyes. Yeah? So I don't need to sequence her to know that she has blue eyes. You know, I can see her, but by seeing her, I also can infer something about her genes. Okay? So genotyping is very difficult. You know, sequencing genes is very difficult. But phenotyping is kind of easy. So if I have LeBron James and Danny DeVito, you know, I don't need to genotype them to know that probably LeBron James has the genes, you know, that encode height, and Danny DeVito does not. Okay? By the same token, figuring out what is the computational capacity of an economy, you know, who embodies which knowledge and know-how is kind of difficult. But what is simpler is to look at what are the things that people make. You know, in some sense, this little book, you know, even if you don't read it, it tells you that maybe I know how to write, you know? But the fact that I've never built, you know, like a car, tells you that I don't know nothing about mechanics, and that would be true too, okay? So in some sense, the things that we do are expressions of the knowledge that we have, you know, the things that we know how to make. And that is true for countries, that is true for cities, and that is true for firms, you know? So let's look at, you know, how places or entities are connected to the things that they do. You know, so the first observation is that economies are highly nested, okay? So nestedness is a pattern that was discovered by ecologists that were looking at insular habitats, you know? And what this means is that here I have a matrix that I have every municipality in Chile or every country in the world, and I have sorted them from the most diverse to the least diverse because the black dots tell you that an industry is present on that location or that a country is producing that product. On the horizontal axis, I have all of the industries, you know, according to Chilean tax classification, of all of the products according to international trade data. And I have sorted them such that the product that is produced by the larger number of municipalities or countries is on the left. And these matrices are highly nested. They're very triangular. And what this is telling you is, well, the places that make few things, you know, make subsets of the things that are made in the places that make more things. You know, and those subsets are kind of continuous. Well, why would that be? Well, because the places that make few things, they can form relatively small networks. And those relatively small networks can form things that are also possible to create in places that can form small networks and large networks, you know? So in some sense, the path of development is one that goes, you know, from producing a few things that are very ubiquitous to one of producing diverse things, including things that, you know, are available only in very few places, okay? But it's not a pattern of, like, a specialization, a pattern of diversification in which specializations happen in that margin, okay? So that's, you know, the first fact. But obviously, this is just one little strand in the rope of evidence. The second strand in the rope of evidence is that economies diversify towards related varieties. So what that means is that the mix of products that a country makes predicts the mix of products that they're going to make in the future. Economies are like Rubik's cubes. Okay? The things that you're going to be able to do next depends on the position that you are now. So you cannot solve an economy, you know, in one move. You know, if you want to go in a Rubik's Cube from a position to the final configuration, usually you're going to have to make many successive moves, and each one of these successive moves is path-dependent. It depends on the position that the cube is in. The same is true for an economy. The mix of products that it makes, it conditions the type of things that they can do. Why? Well, because economies is made out of these firms and these networks of firms that embody computation, and learning, you know, is very hard. Those networks have problem learning, so it's easier for them to learn things that are similar to the ones that they know than things that are different than the ones that they know. The same is true for people, you know. It's much easier to learn things that are similar to the ones that you know than the ones that you don't know. So let's look at that. And for that, I'm going to show you, you know, an example from the Observatory of Economic Complexity. It's a tool that I show you that we created at MIT, you know. And we actually have created a bunch of these data visualization engines also for local economies too, you know. But here what I'm looking at is the product space of Chile. And each one of these dots represents a product. The ones that are painted represent the product that Chile exports. And the ones that are gray represent the product that Chile does not export. So, for example, you can see that Chile, in 1979, exported a lot of preserved fish, but do not export frozen fish fillets or fresh fish. But we know that these products are connected. And what that means is that basically the countries that export one are likely to export the other. So Chile should develop reveal comparative advantage in that product as time goes by. Okay? While Chile should not develop reveal comparative advantage in a product that is far from the ones that they do. For instance, in polishing stones or interchangeable tool parts, because at that time, Chile was not producing any of those products, so we didn't have like the genotype, you know, to make those things. Yeah? So let's see if that is the case. So you see that Chile is producing like a few products here in the fishing cluster and another products here in the processed food clusters. For instance, they're producing miscellaneous fruit, temporarily preserved fruit, but they're not exporting too much fruit or vegetable uses or vegetables, you know, or baked goods. You know? So now let's look at the year 1997. And if we look at the year 1997, you see that now Chile exports fresh fish and they export frozen fish fillets. And they basically diversified towards many of the products that were close by to the ones that they did in the product space. You know? And this is actually true in general. The ROC curves of these machine learning algorithms are actually quite accurate. You can, you know, predict a large fraction of the new products that a country is going to make simply by knowing what position they occupy in the product space. So that's the second strand in the rope of evidence. The third strand relates to economic growth. And economic growth, you know, it's an old idea that goes to like a friend from the north of here, you know, a Scottish friend, Adam Smith, you know. And Adam Smith was the first one to try to kind of like explain economic growth in terms of capital and labor. You know, he understood that capital as something that would augment the capacities of people to make things. Okay? But then those theories were mathematized actually much later. You know, Smith didn't mathematize his ideas. You know, he was a much more of a narrative thinker like Darwin. And one of the people to mathematize his ideas was Robert Solow. And he created a model in which we try to explain economic growth using capital and labor. But what he finds is that even though the model is an okay theory, there's a big gap between what the model says and, you know, the empirical data that he had available. And that gap, you know, is something that then many economists try to later explain. Some of these are people like Paul Romer and Gregory Mankiw that they say, well, you know, it's not just things, you know, and people. People have to know how to do things. So there has to be something like human capital, you know. And if you want to make something that is catchy in economics, you have to put capital as the last name of it, because if not, they're not going to pay attention to you, you know. So they said it has to be something like human capital. And then when they did that, they incorporated that into the growth regressions. Oh, yeah, and it actually helped explain a little bit more. So they were closing that gap a little bit. And then people like Putnam and Fukuyama and others, you know, they say, well, there's also social capital. You know, people can know things, but if they're all assholes and they don't like each other, they're not going to get that far anyway. You know, so people also have to be able to connect, you know, and that's important. And it was added in, and there is a little bit of evidence that actually social capital does matter for economic growth, you know, and institutions, you know. And the thing is, you know, when we think of the world in these terms now and think of, you know, collective computers that create things, we can reinterpret all of these variables and realize that there was one that is missing. No? Because now we have this firm that are these networks that compute products, and obviously they can exchange things like crystals of imagination, which would be physical capital, you know, that they can use then to produce things. Individuals need to know stuff, so they need to have human capital, you know, and people need to have a certain ability to connect, so there has to be social capital or trust. But what is missing from this picture is the knowledge and know-how that is accumulated at the collective level, not at the individual level. And that's not a direct relationship from the knowledge that is embodied in the individuals. Because you can have a lot of individuals that have a lot of human capital, but if that human capital is redundant, or those individuals are not connected in the right way, in the right combination, they're not going to be able to compute a very complicated thing. It's like a computer that has just processors but no RAM, you know? So in some sense, you need to have that diversity, and you need to connect it in the right way. So there has to be knowledge and know-how that is accumulated at the collective level. And that's what I call economic complexity. So, you know, in 2009, I published a paper on PNAS in which I developed a method to measure economic complexity by looking at these matrices connecting countries to the products that they export. And what is funny about this is that economic complexity correlates with GDP per capita very well, but that's not very surprising because a lot of things correlate with GDP. What is interesting is that the deviations from this correlation predict future economic growth. So what this is telling you is that, well, you know, when you have economies like India or China that are relatively sophisticated computers but are making little money, those economies are doomed to grow. When you have economies like Saudi Arabia and Oman that are unsophisticated computers, you know, and are making a lot of money, well, in that case, it's probably because they're making a lot of money just by selling atoms that were buried underground. You know? And when you have an economy like Greece that doesn't even have the atoms, hey, probably they borrow the money. Okay? But over the long run, you know, There is a regression to the mean that happens here, you know, and countries that are more sophisticated computers tend to grow to a level of income that is akin with the sophistication of their economy. You know, and finally, you know, we find that not only economic complexity predicts future income, but it's actually a very good factor that explains and predicts income inequality. So countries might be very rich because they produce a lot of natural resources, but those countries tend to be very unequal because the mix of products that a country makes also determines how that income is distributed. And that's a longer story that is in a forthcoming paper in which we connect, you know, the mix of products that a country makes with the institutions that co-evolve with that industrial structure. So I'm going to summarize now, and I'm going to say that the universe is made of energy, matter, and information, but information is the one that makes the universe interesting. Information is the one that gives the universe its structure, its beauty, and its complexity. And for information to grow, we looked at three mechanisms. Information is not free. You need energy to produce information. Information is hard to preserve, so you need to be able to save it in solids. And for information to grow, you need to have ways of recombining it, so matter needs to have a capacity to compute. But what ultimately this story is all about is about the re-embodiment of computation in ever more complex structures. So you can think now that a cell is a computer, and a tissue is a computer, and a human is a computer, and a network of humans is a larger computer, and a city is an even larger computer. You know? And when you think about in those terms, what makes the growth of information difficult, what makes the growth of more sophisticated forms of order difficult, is this continuous embodiment of computation that is required because all of these units that I just mentioned have a finite capacity to compute. And because these units have a finite capacity to compute, the only way that they can transcend themselves is by creating social structures that allow them to compute at an even higher level of complexity. But when you think about the world in these terms also, the natural sciences and the social sciences are all part of a continuum. Because the only thing that is happening is that the human is just one step on the ladder in which we're embodying computation in ever more complex structures. So with that, I would like to thank you very much for your time and your patience, and then we can take some questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Cesar. I think you've all got a flavor of the energy, the originality. The book is absolutely teeming with ideas, and I know our researchers here working on understanding our future economy and society will be sort of falling upon it like wolves. The book is full of like wonderful kind of quotable moments, and I scribbled lots of them, but there was one I particularly liked, which was when you said that what an economy does is make us not richer but wiser. But I was just going to put it to you that there are many people out there that might say we're on an economic path that's not leading us in an especially wise direction. Mm. It could actually be leading us towards the extinction of our very species. Yeah. So do you feel optimistic about the future?
I feel very optimistic because this doomsday mentality has always existed. It's not new. It might be more present to us now in its current form because it's been discussed. But for instance, you know, for a long time, people have been thinking about, like, you know, the sustainability of the oil economy. Mm. And like a few weeks ago, like basically Elon Musk comes with this battery that can do like 10 megawatts hour of energy and you can buy for $3,000. And now you don't need a big power plant at the edge of town because you can produce energy locally, store it. So I'm a big believer that the big changes in society do not necessarily come so much from the conversations that we have, but from the technology that we make. Because usually, you know, it's very hard to change someone's mind by talking to them. You know, it's much easier to change the things that they have in their hands and let them change their mind themselves. You know, and in some cases, I do think that technology is always saving us from ourselves, and I don't see how it's gonna not continue to do so. I think we can have the pessimism because maybe we have ignorance of the great things that are happening. You know, but when you're in a place like the MIT Media Lab, when I have a colleague that built his own legs, there's another colleague that is building a USB port for the brain, and you see like all of the things that basically are almost unthinkable but are becoming a reality, you become a little more hopeful about the future.
Okay. So get ourselves to MIT. Okay, I won't take up much more time because I think we'll have lots of questions from the audience.
Bruce Tofield, our fellow. You emphasize the importance of trust in creating sustainable networks.
Yes.
My sense is that in countries like the USA and in the UK, trust isn't necessarily on an upward trajectory. You know, you've got mistrust due to kind of employment situation and, you know, shooting of black people in America and so on. If trust is degrading for whatever reason, does this create a problem? You know, you say from a systems point of view, these countries will continue, hopefully, to improve their complexity and therefore improve quality of life. But if trust goes down, that may be a countervailing force.
That's absolutely correct. And then there is obviously like a very famous book on the decline of social capital in America that is called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. And there, you know, he argues that trust and social capital have been eroding, you know, by looking at a number of different instances in which, you know, of participation that have been declining. At the same time, you know, sometimes you can have mistrust between groups, which I think is wrong, but at the same time, isolated groups can preserve trust and do amazing things. So, for example, in the context of the US, there is a lot of trust that exists between rich entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, and they're able to do great things together in that context, and they're not that much affected for the mistrust that is caused by events in Baltimore or Cleveland, which I think is tragic. But I do agree with you that in the long run, you know, a reduction of trust obviously breaks links that are required for these computers to function properly and to help information grow. So the decline in trust is something that you have to be concerned about, and you not only have to fight at the systemic level, but also at the individual level, because sometimes a lot of this mistrust comes from, you know, forms of discrimination that sometimes are even invisible to those that do them.
You've spoken a lot about products. Does the same theory apply to services, banking, insurance, or particularly things like health, national health services?
Yeah. So, yeah, in some way, let me show you, if I can show you a couple of slides, because actually that works very well. So, as I told you before, we have not only created this site, which is Observatory of Economic Complexity, but we also created this other site called Data Viva. This site makes available data for the entire formal sector of the Brazilian economy. This is 1 billion visualizations with a B. Okay, so that's a lot of visualizations. And makes available data for the entire formal sector economy, including products and services and educational institutions, you know, and occupations and salary data. And we find that most of the things work relatively the same when you translate into the world of services, you know, because there is no reason to believe that if there are, let's say, two industries that are similar, they're more likely to learn from each other. Two industries that are producing services that are similar will also learn from each other. What is more surprising, though, is that these things also apply to the production of culture. So, I'm not online. If I would be online, I would be able to show you this site that's called Pantheon, that is a data visualization engine that looks at cultural production. So we took at all people that have a presence in more than 25 languages in the Wikipedia, and that's a data set of 11,334 historical biographies. And we also find that the historical production of countries, as proxied by their biographies, go from a few types of cultural domains that are very ubiquitous to a large diversity of cultural domains that are actually, you know, very rare in some cases. You know, so we find the same nestedness, the same path dependencies when we look at culture, not only at products or services. Yeah.
My name is Alistair Merler. I'm professor of linguistics. Trust is playing a huge role already for quite some time in intellectuals' discussion about where the world should go. I think you gave a very interesting definition of two people between whom trust could arise as somehow being able to promote one's the other person's interests over your own. My rephrasing of it. But the question, I was immediately thinking about how my iPhone asks whether I can trust, whether he can trust the laptop I'm connecting it to, and it's more a matter of syncing, at least syncing, synchronizing information, right, rather than promoting interest. Can you comment on that? There must be different notions of trust involved.
One of the questions I have for you is, you talk about information growing as though all information is the same. What happens when you have information which becomes useless? And I'm sort of thinking specifically about the example of the German economy is very heavily centralized around car manufacturing. It's a big part of their economy. As cars become more about algorithms than about suspension and engines, how does that impact that economy, and how does that impact your theory?
My name's Andrew, I'm a fellow. Thank you for your presentation. You've characterised the economy and almost sort of development as an emergent property of a complex adaptive system. And my question is that that isn't necessarily the way that people are taught to understand an economy or human development or any systems. We're taught in very sort of reductionist analysis, hierarchical, that are experiences of hierarchy rather than perhaps the more sort of complexity theory type approaches that exist in organizations. So is there something that could be done at the very sort of basic education level on an understanding of economics that would help to move away from the sort of reductionist approach to the same sort of idea that it's an emergent property of a complex system?
So the three are good questions. Let me try to answer those three, because if not, I'm going to get overloaded. So the first one regarding trust, a lot of actually like modern, you know, online services, what they do is engineering of trust. Think of Uber. Uber, in some sense, is a service that helps you develop trust with a stranger that you're going to get into a car and it's going to drive you to another place, you know, and it helps engineer that trust because of the type of system. And I'll tell you a story that happens to me. It's like I was coming back to Boston a few weeks ago, and I took an Uber from the airport, and when I step off, you know, this jacket has shallow pockets, and I lost my wallet. And then I get home, and I was going, wow, shit, my wallet, where is it? You know, and then I realized that I lost it in the Uber, and, well, since the Uber driver was there and everything, I was able to contact the system. The guy came back, and he gave me the wallet. If I would have lost it in an actual taxi, I would have never gotten back. It's very hard to contact like a random taxi that you grab on the street. You know, Airbnb is another system that tries to engineer trust. So in some cases, these systems are engineering trust among people. In other cases, they're engineering trust among devices. Because maybe, you know, you want your laptop to trust your phone, but you don't want your laptop to trust any Bluetooth connection that is floating around the environment, because someone can have a virus or someone might be sniffing for passwords and so forth. So a lot of like what the internet is about in an institutional setting is of developing these technological solutions to help engineer trust. Even you can think of Bitcoin as something to engineer trust. Bitcoin is a way of verifying transactions, and it's not just for money. You can verify that you have exchange a social security number, you know, correctly, or a passport number correctly using Bitcoin because of the way that it works. So the blockchain technology is also another way of engineering trust. And there's a lot of like trust engineering that has evolved with the internet, but obviously is previous to that in other more paper forms in the past. Regarding the obsolescence of computational capacities, you know, so it's true, like some computational capacities become obsolescent, you know, and not only at the global macroeconomic level, but also at the individual level. You know, we can even go back in history. Think of the invention of the printing press and what happened to all of the scribes, you know. And in many places, the scribes declare that the printing press came from the devil, you know, obviously because they were losing their jobs, you know. And nowadays, you also have a lot of jobs that have become obsolescent because of the internet. But the people that are displaced from their jobs, also there's a correlation with the generation that they're from. You know, because the type of skills that people acquire depends on the technological era that they're born in. You know, so in that context, you know, there is information, there is computation, because when you're thinking about the car manufacturing industry, you're thinking about computation. There is computation that becomes redundant, or there is computation that, in some sense, becomes more widespread. You know, and that reduces the complexity of those products. You know, in the context of our measure, because now there are countries that are not so sophisticated that are able to make them. If you look at car manufacturing as an example, car manufacturing was on the top 50 out of 1,000 most sophisticated products in the 60s. Now it's like in the top 300. It has gone down a lot, okay? Because when you look at car manufacturing in the 60s, you had countries like France, Germany, the UK, and the US making cars. Then you start to have Japan also there. Nowadays, a lot of cars are manufactured also, you know, in Turkey, in Thailand, in Brazil, in South Africa, you know, in countries that you wouldn't imagine because they don't have a brand, but they have the factories, you know. So also, you know, there is like a spread of that knowledge, and as the knowledge spreads and the computation becomes more ubiquitous, it becomes, you know, less valuable in the market, you know, because of like price and demand for computation type of effects. So, yeah.
And finally, economics, making it more complex, making it more the teaching of economics.
So as I mentioned before, I don't think that it's very easy to change the minds of people by talking to them. You know, you can make them upset, and the good ones, then actually they think about why they were upset, and then maybe they change a little bit. But it's easier to change the minds of people by changing the things that they have available. So when we create the sites like the one that I showed before, like Data Viva or the Observatory of Economic Complexity or Pantheon, the way that I think about this is that they're not just tools, but they're also Trojan horses for ideas. Because if you go to Google and you search, what does the United Kingdom export? What does Ireland export? What does Ireland export to Malaysia? The first link that Google gives you is a link to my site. And when you start exploring my site, you're going to bump into a product space, you're going to bump into economic complexity, and you're going to start understanding the world in that way, maybe, because you're learning from it. There's 500,000 people that hit that site every month. You know, so in that context, you know, we're making available tools that people then adopt and hopefully help them see the world in a different way. Also with Data Viva now, that is a project that we have done in collaboration with the state of Minas Gerais in Brazil. We're trying to take that resource, you know, and create an educational curriculum that would teach students to interpret data, then to create the stories from data, and then to program data. But at the same time, they're going to be doing it with data about the economy of their countries. So they're going to have to start thinking about that data in basically the paradigm that were presented to them. You know, so there are also ways of creating online education based on resources that were born online, that were translated into an online format, you know, through more antiquated technology. So that's the approach that I'm trying to do to help go in that direction, build Trojan horses. Yeah.
Well, we have actually gone over our time, so we have to wrap up. But I think that's absolutely testament to the huge fertility of the set of ideas that César has presented to us today and are obviously contained in the book. Please thank again the terrific César.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.